Happy New Year, Shay Anything listeners. It's Doug and Andy back hosting.
Doug who?
Doug Williams and Andy Martino. I would think that if you're this far into the podcast, you probably know who you're listening to at this point.
Maybe it's your first time.
Thank you to everybody who's been, I've been using the word clamoring to Andy, who mocks me for using it.
There's a furor for a new Shay Anything. I'm like, I saw four tweets and we appreciate those
people. I rarely get like four or five tweets about the same topic. And I've gotten a lot of tweets that are like, hey, when's Shay Anything coming up? So there are loyal listeners out there who want to hear from
me. I will tell you that our analytics people tell us that one tweet about please do a Shay Anything represents, it's like a ratings point. It represents 10,000 people or something.
Right, yeah. So, well, at this point, we're in the tens of millions of subscribers and listeners. The good news also is that we are just turning down potential advertisers. Like,
batting them away.
Just because we don't have one does not mean we haven't gotten thousands of offers from national companies who for some reason want to sponsor this show. So if you haven't subscribed, please do. If you haven't given us a rating or a review, please do. We're happy to be talking to you all once again. I want to get right into it, Andy, because I think the majority of questions that I've gotten, and I tweeted out asking for some questions. I got a lot of good ones from a lot of you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that. There's all this stuff in my mentions on like a Sunday because of that tweet.
Yeah.
Go on.
So I'm just trying to do my job, Andy. I'm trying to think of which one to begin with. Both a tweet from MetsFan52 and Ethan Dilmanian have to do with Brody's next move. That's kind of where I want to start here. Ethan says, which other free agents are the Mets interested in, particularly big name free agents if those exist? And MetsFan52 says, is Brody still very active in the trade market or is he now set on just waiting for free agents? What would your reaction be to the both of those, Andy?
To the second question, I don't think he's ever been prioritizing free agents or trades. I think he's just active, looking for value on all fronts. And I mean, just as we spoke here, there was a signing of Luis Avalon to a minor league contract.
Good deal.
The J.D. Davis trade last weekend and the Kevin Plawecki trade were two things he'd been working on for a while. I'm sure he's working on other kind of under-the-radar things. I've noticed a pattern, actually, lately where some of his projects actually don't get out, maybe more so than we've seen with the Mets. Like, it's like I found out about the J.D. Davis trade 30 seconds before it happened. I think I was literally, like, on top of the announcement by, like, less than a minute. It wasn't like there were days where we were like...
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes when it's something big enough like Robinson Cano, we're going to find out about it ahead of time. But he's been operating under the radar pretty effectively, actually, much to my chagrin, but to his pleasure, I'm sure. So I'm sure he's still working on trades and free agents. I don't see him differentiating that in his mind. What was the first question?
The first one had to do with which free agents are the Mets still interested in. Like, let's make it even more specific. Do you see them signing another fairly big name before the end of the offseason?
I wouldn't call it likely, but I wouldn't call it impossible either. I know that they're sort of monitoring where things go with Marwin Gonzalez and AJ Pollock. I would say Gonzalez might be a little more likely at this point because of his positional flexibility. I wouldn't consider either of those guys likely, to be very clear. But especially with Pollock, where it's like, where is this exactly going? I think there might be a shot to get him, because of the injury concerns, a fair amount below what he was initially looking for. So that's something to keep, if not keep an eye on, just understand that the door is not totally closed. It's the same thing with Gonzalez, sort of seeing where it all goes. There's a lot of interest in Marwin Gonzalez, and if there's a bidding war, I don't think the Mets are going to be aggressively involved in that. But neither guy is signed. That remains something to keep an eye on. And then just it's tough to say which players, because, look, Luis Avalon, there were a number of lefty relievers that they were thinking about, and that's the one that they reached an agreement with. So it could be just look at their needs. They need to back up shortstop. They could always use a little bit more bullpen depth, definitely looking at rotation depth. And those are the areas at which you can look at the pool of available guys on minor league deals or low-end free agent deals and in that depth kind of category and see any one of those guys. Then it becomes like, all right, you're talking to 10 agents. Who are you actually going to shake hands with at the end of the
Yeah, I want to acknowledge a good question we got from Matt Kelly, which has to do with who their backup shortstop might be. As Andy just kind of articulated, it's going to come down to probably a 10 guys who are still on the free agent market. Whoever you can get with the most upside, Brody will sign. It'd be impossible for us to know the name, I don't think.
Yeah, you'd like to get the name if you can, but when it comes to a category like that, it's more of like they're going to sign a Luis Avalon type.
Right. So here's really, we came to this realization, at least I did on Baseball Night in New York last night, which is that the two names you mentioned, Marwin Gonzalez and A.J. Pollock, have been really the two biggest names for the Mets that we've talked about for the last couple weeks. Mm-hmm. And before the Mark Feinstein report yesterday that it looks like Machado to the Phillies, Harper back to the Nats is gaining momentum, I would have said if the Mets signed A.J. Pollock, that is the cherry on top of a very good offseason. Mm-hmm. They improved their team dramatically. I'm wondering if that can be true. If the Mets do sign A.J. Pollock, but after Bryce Harper goes back to the Nats and Manny Machado goes to the Phillies, will we still feel like, yeah, good offseason, well done, Brody? Or is your offseason predicated on what the teams in your division do?
Of course it is. Those are your competitors, right? So
right.
I could break 5 stories and feel good about myself, but if Jeff Passan breaks 10, then he did better, you know? So yeah, you need to be mindful of what your competitors can do.
But Brody can't control what they do.
Of course not. He can only execute his plan, but the goal, of course, is to finish with a better record than those teams. That's his mandate.
That definitely is true. But I guess what I'm talking about here is the whole winning the offseason narrative. And if you are Brody and you're going to answer to, like, I'm trying to put myself in his shoes. You and I both agree that the Mets should be at least in on Bryce Harper. They are not.
Absolutely. The fact that they're not is a real shame. It would be a more than a perfect fit. And they are watching their competitors meet with him. They're watching the Yankees flirt with Machado, although not that heavily. They're watching the Phillies and the Nationals look at Machado and Harper. And if you're a Met fan, as we said on the show last night, you spend your time and your money loving the New York Mets, and they're not taking a meeting with Harper or Machado, I think that should bother you.
Why?
I'm sure it does.
Why wouldn't they at least take a meeting? And maybe they have talked to Boris casually about it at some point, maybe at the winter meetings. Brody had a short meeting that just never got released to you or any reporters. But why haven't we heard that, at the very least, to appease the fan base, just to see how far away you are from his representatives, why haven't we heard the Mets have kicked the tires but are moving on?
And the Mets are, I think Mets fans and New York fans in general are too savvy for that kind of thing. You're not accomplishing anything from a PR standpoint if you take a meeting or if you make an offer just to finish second and show your fans you tried. I don't think that would be a good strategy.
No, I disagree, because I don't know if
people
we'd ever
see through that, is what I'm saying.
I agree with you if it's that transparent, but you know, I don't know if we would ever find out if the Mets were making an offer just to finish second. Obviously they should not do that. That is not a smart thing to do to your fan base. But if I were a Met fan and I heard that they were legitimately considering this as a possibility, that would at least allow me to feel okay, like they are looking at this superstar player as a possibility, because he should be. The fact that I'm just hearing them with no connection.
But if you know, if you're the Mets, if you know at the beginning of the offseason that Harper has a $300 million offer from the Nationals that he could always fall back on, and you're not going to pay him $300 million, why take the meeting?
Maybe.
Look, I'm not defending. We agree. They should be in on Bryce Harper. I think the Mets should give Bryce Harper 8 or 10 years. He's 26 years old. He's not the player that he was supposed to be when he came into the league. He's never been that guy except for one MVP season. But the symbolic and concrete gestures of having him on your team and showing your fans that you're going for the big fish, and the fact that that guy's face and hair and beard on the billboards in New York. I mean, it would be huge. It would be amazing. They should sign Bryce Harper, but they're not going to.
What do you think is the disconnect with somebody like Harper? Or we can include Machado in this conversation, too. It's not like the Mets have some all-star third baseman or shortstop where he wouldn't have a place on the team. Mm-hmm. What do you think the disconnect is? So let's say they are a 10-year, $300 million contract. They just don't believe that they want to give that out to anybody.
Right. I think that's the case.
But is
and
there...
By the way, that's not stupid in and of itself.
No, and by the way, the Mets aren't alone. There are, what, 28 teams who, it sounds like, don't want to do that? So,
yeah, but I do think Harper and the Mets would be...
I agree with you.
Thing.
We both agree. Yeah. But... Is there an argument to be made, like if you were sitting down with Mets ownership and you were trying to convince them, like you had a PowerPoint presentation trying to convince them that, that let's say Bryce Harper is the perfect player for them to sign to a contract like that. Is there an argument to be made that he as a superstar is actually more profitable than like a Manny Machado because you can put him on the billboards? He's going to sell a ton of jerseys. He's going to put butts in the seats, as they say. Like, do owners and GMs pay attention to that stuff, or has it become strictly what are the numbers like? Is Bryce Harper worth this amount of money, the player? Like, who is he? He had 240 last year, like that kind of conversation.
I think that intangible stuff is less valuable to teams than it ever was. I think that's a good point. Front offices, the more analytically inclined they get, the more they can put on that spreadsheet, here's his value, here's his real dollar value, here, da-da-da. And the less you get owners going, yeah, but it's exciting and fun and da-da-da, because they've got GMs now that can bring those analytics to them and show them exactly what it would apparently mean financially. And probably those intangibles don't pay off the way that people used to
think they
did.
You're probably right. Yeah. And
like in real financial terms.
It was an interesting idea from Adam Fisher in our show email for tonight's show at 6 o'clock. He basically said the way baseball used to work was if you were bad the year before, you would sign someone like that because you're trying to get over the hump and you would ignore their weaknesses and you just be like, we have to get better. So if this high-priced right fielder is better than our right fielder, just sign him because we have to be better next year.
Right.
But how many teams that were bad last year are looking at it totally differently?
Just like, the White Sox and the Phillies.
Well, yeah.
That's it.
But the Phillies, I mean, they were good for, what, half the year?
Yeah, but they were atrocious.
Right. They obviously, they had some issues exposed.
And their whole thing is exposed, but that's another topic. I don't think that's a franchise that's going in the right direction. But
where did that go?
The Phillies?
No, where did that feeling of being bad and let's try and get better players so we're good?
It came from front offices getting smarter and the union would argue cheaper.
Why do you think it's smarter not to?
Why do I personally think it's smarter? I'm not saying that's my opinion, but it comes down to the analytics, that they can now assign a monetary value to player performance more specifically. I think you used to go, hey, that guy's a superstar. I like the cut of his jib. Bring him in.
Yeah.
Pay him. And now it's like, actually, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like defensive metrics show that Bryce Harper isn't much of a two-way player. Whereas you might have been able to say, oh, he's a pretty good outfielder before, something like that. Or just the idea of generating buzz or creating excitement. I think teams are more now into the provable value rather than that intangible, which is not as tangible. Now, they can look at, I'm sure they can look at merchandise and things, season ticket sales and things like that, but it probably just doesn't compute. If it did, more teams would do it, I guess. I mean, I know that I'm getting a little out of my depth of knowledge here, but I know that, for example, like jersey sales and T-shirt sales and all that is divided up through the league. So, like the Tim Tebow T-shirts don't do anything for the Mets that they don't do for the White Sox, I'm pretty sure. You know,
That's weird.
That's revenue shared, I think. Teams just get less excited about that. And owners love the GM that can say, why do you think all these analytics guys have taken over? One of the reasons owners love the GM who can say, like, you don't have to spend that much money. You can still be good if you do these moves. Owners go, great, smart kid. I'll spend less money.
Yeah.
You're hired.
I just worry about the future of that line of thinking, though.
Sure. A lot of people
do. Did you see A-Rod talking with a bunch of players talking about the value?
I
saw some of it, too. And I'm curious to hear your reaction to it because basically, in case any of you didn't hear it, A-Rod's talking about the value of the player when he played, specifically him, and what he was given in his contract. and basically uses it like a ratio. So the value of teams is greater now than when A-Rod played. So if the value, if the income for teams is greater, why haven't the contracts exponentially grown as well? Which at first you hear that and you're like, there are still players making an astronomically large amount of money. But his point being Manny Machado, Bryce Harper contracts like that, they should be, there should be a $50 million player in the league because incrementally the income for teams is going up at that rate.
Well, look, no, obviously we're not breaking any news to say that the economic model of baseball is changing dramatically and there's a ton of unrest about it on the labor side. And that's what's going on. That's the underlying theme of the game until we get to the next CBA and possibly another work stoppage.
Yeah.
As it relates, though, how do we get here? Where were we?
Basically,
Bryce Harper and the Mets?
Yeah, I veered us away from the Mets quickly because it just confuses me where we are. And what made me think of it was basically making the point that the Mets are not alone. There's 28 other teams that aren't interested in these two guys.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that seems weird because there are a lot of teams that missed the playoffs last year, and they're good players.
You get into specifics, though. Take the Yankees and Machado as an example. Then you take, like, why wouldn't everyone want Manny Machado for $300 million? You go, well, I guess a concrete example now of what you're saying, like, what does smart mean? I guess smart means that Miguel Andujar's production at $550,000 is not $28 million worse than Manny Machado's. Andujar, they can now say, Miguel Andujar is worth, I'm making this up, he's worth $2 million less than Manny Machado next year. So why would you give Machado $28 million more?
Why is he going to get that contract from anybody? Why is Michael Franco?
Well, now it's two teams that are willing to do it instead of, like, more. You know, that's what you're saying. It's going down.
It depends entirely on the values of that specific front office.
Context of the situation, yes. Values of the front office, where a team is. Now, the Phillies are actually trying to do that old school splash thing. They're trying to get good, but they're trying to show their fans that they're back in the game. You know, the Phillies of the Ruben Amaro Jr. years used to spend a ton of money, have high payrolls, stars. They used to go towards the end, they were getting Cliff Lee and Roy Halladay and loading up. And they're trying to show their fans that they're ready to do that.
They're basically saying, if you haven't been to a game since Chase Utley and Ryan Howard were on the field for us, we're going to get you back in the seats.
So the Phillies are actually attempting to do, in part, what you're saying people don't do anymore. Excite people.
Yeah.
The intangible, that. In addition to becoming a better baseball team.
Well, so let's bring things back to the Mets and Brody. So you and I have talked a lot about Brody's rhetoric so far this offseason. And his big picture ideas, his, I don't want to call them predictions, but proclamations that in that room they consider themselves the favorite, that quote got a lot of pub. Let's say Harper re-signs with the Nationals, making them a very, very good baseball team. They've had a great offseason already. Let's say Machado signs with the Phillies. They're still a work in progress, but who knows if they'd be done. How do you think Brody would then, what would he do next? What would his reaction be? Would it be to be the same guy? Would it be to, you know what, let's sign AJ Pollock? Or would it be to kind of go radio silent, reevaluate things, and see how much he thinks that matters?
Great question. I think that, I don't know the answer to that. I would expect that he already believes he's putting together the best team he can possibly put together, and he'll continue on that course. Will they be motivated by those moves potentially happening in their division to stretch their budget further than what they had intended? I mean, maybe. It's a good question.
Well,
see how it plays out.
Two conversations we've already had. The reaction, let's sell tickets, sell jerseys style of thinking, which you said is kind of extinct, although the Phillies are doing it, versus the analytical, like looking deeply at each player. So let's take that conversation and move it to the division thing that you were just mentioning with Brody. So do GMs and front offices see moves that are made by the Phillies, by the Nationals, your rivals, and feel like we got to make a move? Like
sometimes yes, sometimes no. Really. That was one of the discussions in the Yankee front office was because the Red Sox won the World Series, does that mean we have to do something? And some people think yes and some people think no.
And by the way, that same decision, what's funny is we used to have this conversation with the Yankees and Red Sox all the time, like Jose Contreras when the Yankees got him and Theo Epstein threw the chair out the window, apparently, and like it was always this competition.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I always looked at that like it was a rivalry-based thing, but the first point you made when I brought up the other teams in the National League East and their off seasons, first point you made was you have to. That's your competition.
Right.
Like you have to try and be better than those teams.
Right. You're
so I guess yeah. I shouldn't simplify a GM or front office trying to out-act their competition because you literally have to beat those teams to get into the postseason.
Right. The entire goal of running a baseball team, obviously, is to get into the postseason and win a championship. So that's contingent. And what that requires, if you're the poor Tampa Bay Rays, who probably would have won the National League, almost any division in the National League last year, if not all of them, and couldn't do it. So what I mean is it's different depending on what your reality is. It's a lot easier for the Cleveland Indians to win their division than it is for the Tampa Bay Rays to win theirs, or frankly, the Mets to win theirs. So you have to keep that in mind. That's why the Indians are willing to trade Bauer or Kluber, because they could win the division without one of those guys, because it's a horrible division. But if they played in the AL East, they wouldn't be able to entertain that thought. So yes, context is everything here. Is that what you're talking
about? Yes, totally. And it worries me that there are a lot of teams giving up. Not what the Mets are doing,
and
obviously.
That's what's cool about the Cano trade and giving up Jared Kelnick and all this stuff is that if you're trying to win this year, that puts you in the top, like, 20th percentile right there.
Right.
Just by trying.
That's wrong.
I agree. And so does the union, I guarantee you that.
And by the way, I say that's wrong, and if you're going to call me a hypocrite, by the way, you have a fair argument, because I was the one who thought that the Mets should trade DeGrom and Syndergaard at some point.
You did think that.
But
is it
possible to trade off good assets to get a good young return and think that you can turn it around and try and win soon?
It often gets simplified rebuilding versus
Making smart business decisions.
Now, sometimes teams break it down to the studs, like the Astros and the Cubs did a few years ago and built it back up and won. But yes, of course, there's a middle ground. That's what the Indians are currently doing. They say, we can win a division without Yan Gomes. We might be able to win a division without one of those starting pitchers. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it.
There was some rumors, and I do want to get to it before we go, because I know it seems like an old story.
Before we go, we just started.
We got some time left. Brian Dozier, there was a report by John Heyman that the Mets and Brian Dozier had been talking, which on the surface to me didn't make much sense, but then he gets signed by the Nationals. Do you think the Mets were ever close in on him?
No.
You don't?
No, I mean, they might have had a conversation or two, but
yeah.
No, that's not like something that...
But that's not I shouldn't read more into that maybe they're looking for another like power-hitting infielder. Like that kind of took me, caught me off guard, because that's not where I've been thinking the Mets were going to go with their next sign.
I didn't think they were going to sign Brian Dozier. So,
right. Center field.
Right.
Would they be content if they're done out there?
Yeah. Yes. Would their fans be? No.
No.
But no, I think that that between Broxton, Rajay Davis, Juan Lagares, Nimmo, Conforto, they feel like they've got so many people that can play center field to varying degrees, from Broxton at the beginning of that continuum of quality to, Conforto on the other side of like barely being able to play center field. But yeah, they feel like they're covered in center field.
What worries me is that there is seemingly so much, there's a lot of names there. And if Brody is making the decision to sign AJ Pollock, it would now surprise me considering how many names he'd be above on the depth chart. Like, do you really want two of those guys to be in AAA? Because that might be what you're looking
at. And that's why I said that I agree with you. And that's why I said that if you had to choose between Marwin Gonzalez and Pollock in terms of likelihood right now, although neither is especially likely, they see Pollock is not such a positional fit anymore. And he is until Cespedes comes back, because then you have another outfield spot to play with. And all the guys I just mentioned obviously could also play a corner. And Conforto and Nimmo obviously are much better suited to a corner. So in 2019, without Cespedes, you could go Pollock, Conforto, Nimmo, Broxton Lagares as your outfield. But once Cespedes comes back, then you're displacing a player that you like in Conforto, Nimmo, probably.
There is a...
If you have Pollock, you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. There is a significant, in my opinion, lack of power, even if the Mets sign one of those two guys.
Because sure.
We keep talking about Wilson Ramos, maybe 100 games. Then you go over to first base, like, can you count? You can't count on Peter Alonso for anything because he's never played in the big league. So, like,
don't forget Cano. Honestly.
Cano.
Yeah.
Cano has power. But at Citi Field, is he a 30 home run guy? I don't know. Then Amed Rosario at short. Todd Frazier is good for 25, but he's going to hit 220. Conforto and...
If he gets in the lineup enough health-wise to hit
right.
25.
Yes. And Conforto and Nimmo are quality hitters, but, you know, they'll be in the teens to 20s. And then you're looking at Keon Broxton. Are you really going to rely on him to hit you home runs? Like,
he did it 1 year, but yeah.
1 year.
You know who I think is... Not that this is an answer to your question, but non-Mets spinning people, like legitimate, like, independent parties are really high on J.D. Davis and that power potential. I believe he had 18 home runs in 80 games. Fact check me on that. It's an estimate in my mind that I have in my mind, but something like that in Fresno in the Pacific Coast League. And people say, Pacific Coast League, Las Vegas, come on. Fresno is a pitcher's park where it's really hard to hit a ball out of. And J.D. Davis crushed home runs in that ballpark. And people are like, he's a stud.
Well, I'm glad you brought J.D. Davis up because we haven't done the podcast. We didn't do it last week. And the storyline after this weekend when Brody was making all these trades and signings, Hector Santiago and J.D. Davis as well. So why do you think Brody went ahead and traded minor league talent? And by the way, I didn't happen to know any of the names of these prospects that he traded, but
right.
I have heard that some of them had potential, and that's always what you're going to hear with prospects, but it is the case. So why do you think Brody went that route instead of waiting for that fringe free agent crop that we talked about that could pop?
He likes the players. I'm sure that he didn't feel like he gave up an exorbitant amount for them. Fangraphs post believed that the Mets paid too high a price. Brody, in his internal calculations, would disagree. Guess what's going to tell us what's right? Time. Nothing other than
right.
time. But they don't feel... So this whole idea, well, why'd you give up minor league talent instead of just spending? It's like, well, okay. But if you brought in, I don't know, the minor league or even major league free agent, a fringe free agent equivalent of J.D. Davis is, but from the beginning of the offseason, they targeted that guy. They liked him. They see something. So they did what they felt like they had to do to get him.
I just have this cynical theory because part of what I try and do, given that I'm just here in the studio every day talking about these guys, is trying to imagine that I'm them. And if I'm trying to imagine myself being a GM, I think to myself, the way that I can be the most effective in my role mm-hmm. as a part scout, part evaluator, part boss, everything you are in that role, is to scour the rest of the big leagues, see players that other teams are ignoring and maybe not giving the time of day, and acquiring them.
Well, that's what they feel like they're doing.
And that's fair. But I think that the potential glory in that, if J.D. Davis ends up being a stud, mm-hmm. is greater than signing Jed Lowry to a free agent contract and him being solid. Like, you're going to get more credit for finding a diamond in the rough on the trade market
sure.
than you will some kind of low-level free agent working out.
Well, that's true. I don't think they're doing it with that in mind.
No.
But that's true. I agree with you.
I don't think that GMs are sitting there selfishly being like, how can I end up looking smart? But I do think that there is part of the thinking that's like, I feel like I can outsmart this other evaluator on the Astros who doesn't see what he has in J.D. Davis.
Yeah, maybe. Sure, that's the competitive aspect of doing a trade, probably. And just trying to find the players that you think will make the team the best it can be. And we've talked about this on BNNY and I've written about it, but the idea of these moves was to just create that depth in the roster, have a better bench, have a better B lineup, and just have guys like, instead of Matt Dendecker being your alternate center fielder on a day game after a night game, having it be Cam Broxton or Juan Lagares.
Right.
And just being better 1 through 25 is the idea here. I don't think you mentioned Jed Lowry as a random example. I don't think he makes you better 1 to 25 because it's sort of just like an awkward fit, whereas he's not that B-team guy. He's somebody's second baseman next year.
Right.
You have Robinson Cano. So it's actually trickier to sign a guy like that if you have players already.
Well, before we go for real now, just want to let you guys know and remind you that next week we're doing a live show at the Queens Baseball Convention.
That's next week?
January 19th.
A week from Saturday?
Yes.
How about that?
So I'm looking forward to seeing hopefully some of you there. We will talk then. But instead of my Saturday night, Andy.
Did you know that when Doug goes out in public, he seems really nice in this thing. When he goes out in public, he like walks right past you. He'll ignore you. I'm going to be super engaging. Doug's going to big time you like you've never been big time.
I don't look strangers in the eye. That's my thing. And I have a large group of security that will be around me at all times.
It's true.
I have 5,000 followers on Twitter, people. You think I'm just going to like shake your hand? I'm a big deal.
It's true. That's what I'm saying. You know who's really like that is Joe Beningo. I've been on DNL with him at Citi Field, and he walks up the set, and people are like, Joe Beningo! And he just won't even. I'm kidding about Doug. I'm not kidding about Joe. He's really like that.
Yeah, I will not be like that. I can't wait to hang out with you guys, honestly. We're very excited. As soon as the Queens Baseball Convention was over last year, we all kind of realized we had missed an opportunity. And we made up for that, and we're like, you know what? This just seems like a great opportunity to mingle with the fans, talk to them, and we can also promote our show. So
we know you're Mets fans, but we know that really, truly, at the end of the day,
you're Shea Anything
fans. You're Shea Anything fans.
Instead of my Saturday night, what'd you do for New Year's?
Oh, my God, that was a long time ago. We just have a great tradition in my house for New Year's. It started when we couldn't get a sitter for New Year's. My wife and my son and I, all right, I'm going to be quick about this. I plan a whole party through the day for the three of us. My son and I go to the record store, local record store in the afternoon. I give him 10 bucks in the dollar bin. We budget that 10 bucks. We pick out some cool records, new records. Then I buy stuff to make a martini for me, which I like. What's the sweet drink with sugar and bourbon in it? I'm just having a complete
old fashioned.
An old fashioned for my wife and for my son, a Shirley Temple. And then we make snacks. I like put different stuff, mozzarella sticks and wings and all the stuff in the oven. And we put out all the snacks, and then we dance to the new records. I make a whole song order. We dance to the new records, and then when we put my son to bed, Ruby, my wife and I watch a challenging movie, like a really sophisticated like foreign film or something that we normally wouldn't have the patience for, from like 10 to 12, and then we do the countdown thing at like 12.
Would you be offended mm-hmm. if I said that tradition is equal parts cute mm-hmm. and strangely specific?
Well, it's evolved like any tradition. It started out like let's do a thing, and now my son's older, so we've had a couple
like,
of reps.
What if your son picks out records that no one in their right mind would dance to? Like if you pick out a Shins record, I don't want to dance to the Shins.
My son's too good for that. He knows okay. what he's doing.
All right. I was in Aspen, Colorado with some friends, and since it is an incredibly sceney place, not saying that's wrong, but it is, we on New Year's Eve just had a pajama party, and we made pasta and relaxed, watched the ball drop. And went.
Why the hell would you pay to be in Aspen to have a pajama party?
Well, because you'd have to pay $500 for that night to go anywhere. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Who wants to do that? But anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. And we will see some of you, I hope, next week. To be determined if we're going to do a regular episode for you until Saturday next week. We may or we may not.
We got to save it up for the live thing.
But yeah, we're going to be live. If you haven't bought tickets already, I don't know if they're still available. Maybe you
StubHub.
Scalp. Yeah, StubHub. They're going for $600 a pop, folks. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day.